House Republicans and Senate Republicans have each passed their own version of a tax overhaul bill known as the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act. It's not a done deal yet. There are differences between the two plans, and lawmakers are trying to work those out this week.
Republicans say the plan has big benefits for business and job growth and sizable tax savings for middle-income Americans. Here's House Speaker Paul Ryan when the House of Representatives unveiled their tax plan.
This plan is for the middle-class families in this country who deserve a break. It is for the families who are out there living paycheck to paycheck who just keep getting squeezed. You know, about half the country today is living paycheck to paycheck, and a lot more people are about a paycheck away from living paycheck to paycheck in this country. And this is going to help give people relief.
Our next guest says to figure out who the tax overhaul really helps, we have to look at how the $1.4 trillion revenue cuts will be paid for and who future spending cuts might affect.
William Gale is a senior fellow in economic studies at the Brookings Institution and co-director of the Urban Brookings Tax Policy Center. He is the co-author of a new report, Winners and Losers After Paying for the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act. Bill, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you. Pleasure to be here.
And a key point you make in this report is don't just look at the $1.4 trillion in tax cuts and see who that affects. You say one way or another, we're going to pay for that and we have to figure out who that's going to impact. Do I have that right?
That's right. Tax cuts are only half of a policy. They have to be, they're the fun part of the policy, but they have to be paid for. And the main message of our paper is that if you look at the ways that Republican leaders in Congress are talking about paying for the tax cuts, it's going to end up making most households, and in particular almost all low-income households, worse off rather than better off.
And before we dig into the details there, there's a one-page statement from the Treasury Department this week says these tax cuts will pay for themselves and eventually will come out ahead thanks to additional economic activity generated by the cuts plus some unspecified future regulatory and other reforms. So by that one sheet from the Treasury Department, we don't need to worry about how to pay for it.
Well, the Treasury one-page memo is I can't be dismissive enough of it. It basically, what Treasury did was take the incredibly optimistic growth assumptions that the administration is using and then looked at the revenue implications of that. And it's sort of a garbage in, garbage out analysis. What Treasury didn't do was analyze the growth effects of the tax bills. What they did was take the administration's assumption about growth and run it through their models. But you know, it's as equivalent to simply assuming a really good outcome and then saying, look, we get a really good outcome. I don't think the Treasury analysis is worth the piece of paper that it's written on.
Now, before we look into kind of the part two here, well, how do we cut spending if we do this tax plan in order to pay for it? Looking at just the tax changes themselves, before we get to those possible future spending cuts or other tax increases, how are those distributed across the income scale?
The good news is they're distributed fairly widely. The bad news is that they are definitely tilted toward the highest income taxpayers. So, for example, households in the bottom 20% of the income distribution will get, on average, a $60 tax cut, so a little over a dollar a week. Households in the top 1% will get about $37,000. On an annual basis. If you look at what happens to after-tax income, the distribution becomes more unequal if the bills were to pass. And so a lot of people do get some tax cuts. There's no question about that. But in terms of where the money is, it's going to high income and very high income households.
And then people have pointed to the what happens after 10 years question. A lot of the individual tax cuts are set to expire because that they needed to do that to get it in under a certain revenue loss ceiling, I guess. Is that right?
Right. That's a really good point. What I said before was for the tax cuts while they exist, but almost all of the individual tax cuts disappear in the Senate bill, although the corporate tax cuts are permanent.
Bill Gale is with us from the Brookings Institution. We're looking at his new report on winners and losers in the tax plans coming out of the House and Senate. And now let's get to the how do we pay for this, about $1.4-ish trillion in revenue loss in the form of these tax cuts. What kind of things, when you look at what Republicans have said about that, do you see getting cut in the next few years?
Well, Paul Ryan has said that they want to go after Medicare, Social Security, entitlements, and so on. And if you look at who benefits from those things, it's predominantly low and middle-income households. A vast proportion of seniors depend on Social Security for, you know, more than two-thirds or more than 90% of their income. Medicare, Medicaid go to predominantly low-income households. And what the Republican leaders have been very clear, what they want to do is cut entitlements.
And they've talked about phasing that in. So people currently relying on, say, Social Security, seniors on any of these programs, they might not face cuts. It's adjusting cuts for younger people. They'll have less to look forward to in the future. Is that how that would probably happen if it came through?
That's one possibility. The proposals that have been put forth in the past for Social Security tend to exempt people who are 55 and older from the adjustments. The Medicare proposals that have been put forth in the past tend to have impact more quickly.
So when you start to account for that, and I know you have to kind of make some educated guesses since there's not an exact plan on the table, but when you start to account for those kind of cuts, how does the distribution of tax cut benefits start to look, again, for lower and middle income Americans?
Right. So what we did was look at three different ways of financing the tax cuts. One was assuming each household paid the same amount in dollars. One is assuming that each household paid the same share of their income, and one is assuming that everyone got the same percentage increase in their income tax. I think the most realistic option, given the fact that Ryan and other Republican leaders have talked about cutting entitlements, the most realistic option is that everyone pays the same amount. And if you do that, then about 70% of the households in the country end up being worse off than they would have been if we had not enacted the tax cut and not pursued the financing option. So almost 100% of households in the bottom 40% of the income distribution, about 71% of households in the middle of the income distribution are worse off.
And how about at the top of the scale?
The top of the scale, it's 20%, 10%, depending on the exact income level. So because of the design of the tax bill is so uneven, you do get some people who end up losing at the top. But predominantly, this is, that household in the bottom quintile that would have got $60 in tax cuts ends up paying $1,200 more in terms of the financing costs. So it's a bad deal. It's a bad trade-off for most households, and in particular for low- and middle-income households.
I should throw another option out there, and that's do nothing. Cut the taxes, cut the revenue by $1.4 trillion, and let it add to the deficit. What would the effect there be?
Right. Well, at some point, we need to pay for the tax cuts. If it adds to the debt, that postpones the day of reckoning. It doesn't eliminate the need to finance tax cuts. But if it adds to the debt, it'll draw investment away from more productive uses and slow the rate of growth, which is one of several reasons why the tax package, looking at it standalone, is not going to be favorable for economic expansion.
William Gale is with us from the Brookings Institution, looking at winners and losers in the Republican tax overhaul plans.
And you can join the conversation by calling 800-642-1234. Do you have a question about the impact these changes could have on the tax system? What do you think of the Republican tax plans that are currently being floated around? And should they be passed or not? And what changes would you like to see? You can call in now at 800-642-1234. Again, that's 800-642-1234, or you can post on the Ideas Network Facebook page.
We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Jay Carlisle Larson. William Gale is with us from the Brookings Institution. He's with us to break down the winners and the losers in the Republican tax overhaul plan.
You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your questions and your comments. What do you think of what you have seen so far from the House and Senate tax overhaul plans? There's a lot going on there. What concerns do you have? What hopes do you have for a change in the U.S. tax system? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll go to your calls now. Peter is with us in Madison. Peter, hi.
Hi. Thank you for covering this subject. This is probably the most important subject you guys could talk about today. And this is really the reason why the Republican Party exists, so that wealthy campaign contributors can get a tax cut so they don't have to pay as much money to the federal government. And that's the reason why the Koch brothers wanted entitlement reform, which is just another name for cutting Medicare and cutting Social Security so that the rich campaign contributors don't pay more money. The thing that really is disappointing to me, though, is that the Democrats don't have a strong message that they can say that really this is class warfare. This is the rich trying to take control of the federal government and pillage the federal government for their benefit. So I was just really disappointed that the Democrats even entertained the idea of a bipartisan tax cut bill here, when it's very clear what the Republicans' intentions were all along, and the Democrats have to have a strong message against it.
Peter, thanks for the call. Bill, your thoughts on the politics Peter is pointing to there?
The Democrats had an interesting strategy on, or an interesting set of guidelines that they produced several months ago. They wanted it to be revenue neutral. They didn't want tax increases for the middle class. They didn't want tax cuts for the rich. And one could have designed a tax reform package around that. They did not do that. And I don't think that there was any real chance for a bipartisan deal here. I think with the Republicans controlling both houses and of Congress and the White House, I think they wanted to do their thing. But I agree that the reform discussion has been largely about largely motivated by politics, as opposed to what they could have done if they had designed a more economically sound package.
Peter, thanks for that call. Bill, let me throw this wrinkle at you as we talk about how this affects lower and middle income Americans. As you're saying, when you weigh the tax cuts they'd get versus spending cuts that would affect them, lower and middle class Americans, most of them would be worse off. The Republican argument, I think, would be, hey, we're lowering corporate taxes. We're making it easier for companies to do business in the United States. There will be more jobs for those lower and middle income Americans and hopefully better pay. Is that something that you see maybe working out that way?
Those are definitely the Republican talking points. I don't think that they hold water. A number of analyses have suggested that the growth effects would not be that big. For a number of reasons, just tick off a few. The increase in the deficit would hamper growth. The elimination of the state and local income tax deduction will raise marginal tax rates. Their proposals to cut back on education and research and development will not help. They're going to make it harder for states to finance education and infrastructure, which will also hurt growth. And they've got a variety of international provisions that actually encourage firms to shift money and jobs overseas. So, the main talking point for growth is that they'll give accelerated deductions for investment and they'll lower the corporate tax. But most analyses suggest that those gains are outweighed by the other things that I talked about. So if they want to design a package for growth, they could have done a lot better
this comes back to the first caller's question, the role of politics in this. Growth is certainly the talking point they're using, but this is not a tax cut that's well designed to stimulate growth.
Let's go back to our callers now. Will is with us in Eau Claire. Will, hi.
Hi, folks, and thanks for taking my question tonight. It's a general one. I've been following this, you know, from a distance, and it seems like it's still evolving, you know, in the conference committee between the House and the Senate. But I'm wondering what you folks know at this time, at this point, about the deductions, the itemized deductions that those of us who are, you know, middle class folks have enjoyed in the past, the state and local income tax deduction, the mortgage interest deduction, you know, that sort of thing.
Well, thanks. Great questions. Bill, what do we know about changes to deductions that affect people in the middle class range?
I think they're going to get smaller. State and local tax deduction is you know, on the chopping block. The mortgage interest deduction is going to be curtailed directly in the amount that can be deducted, but also the increase in the standard deduction is going to make it less attractive to itemize in the first place. Another itemized deduction that hasn't been talked about all that much is that for high medical expenses. The House bill would eliminate that. The Senate bill would actually expand it and make it more generous. And it'll be interesting to see what they do in conference on this.
Well, thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. We're looking at the impact of Republican tax overhaul plans. There's a separate plan in the Senate and the House. They're working to get those together. Our guest co-wrote a report on winners and losers in that plan. Back to your calls now. Chris is on the line in Columbus. Chris, hi.
Hey, great topic as usual.
Thanks.
And I got to ask your guest, my opinion is that all government programs should be paid for, including by the people who are beneficiaries of them. So I am a proponent of a flat tax, no deductions. Everybody pays, you know, 5% of your income, whether it's earned income or dividends and returns. What's your guest's opinion on that?
Flat tax, Bill.
It's a great question. A couple of thoughts. One is that the rate would have to be much higher than 5%. The second is I don't know if it's a politically stable solution. People tend to say, oh, we go to flat tax, you know, you send all the lobbyists home. No, you don't do that. The lobbyists just start over the same game at a new starting point. And it would also be quite regressive relative to the system we have now. I understand the point that there are some programs where you should have the beneficiaries pay, but there's also, in my view at least, there's also a role for government in redistributing income, and that involves having, in some cases, people who are not beneficiaries paying for the benefits that someone else gets.
Thanks for that call, Chris. We'll go now to Nate on the line in Prairie du Sac. Nate, hi.
Thanks for taking the call. I'd like to have the speaker comment on a thing that I have been puzzling. Republicans have tended to say the holy grail of economics is the market, the market, the market, the market. However, I do not understand in terms of this tax legislation of trying to give more and more breaks to wealthier and wealthier people, how that really facilitates the market. Because if there isn't a demand for goods and services, I do not see how putting more hands in the pockets of more money in the pockets of wealthy people who can just put it in investments that don't require the market to act.
Nate, I gotcha. So that, and this is an argument: is it better to have more money in the hands of more people at lower income levels who are more likely to spend it, or top down, as Nate was describing this tax overhaul?
We've had almost 40 years now of trickle-down economics thrown at us. It hasn't worked in the U.S. It didn't work in Kansas. It hasn't worked across other countries. So it comes back to the first caller who asked about the politics of the situation, which I think is dead on. There are ways, I think, to make the economy grow better than sharing benefits on the wealthiest households.
And briefly, Bill, this bill aside, is our tax system due for an overhaul? We don't need to get into the specifics of what it could be, but do we need to make some tweaks?
There's huge room for improvement in the tax system, yes.
We'll leave it there for now. Bill, thanks a lot for joining us today.
All right, thank you.
That's William Gale. He's a senior fellow in economic studies at the Brookings Institution and co-director of the Urban Brookings Tax Policy Center. We've been talking about a report he co-authored on winners and losers in the tax overhaul plans currently before the U.S. Senate and U.S. House. You can still share your thoughts, by the way, on that. Head over to the Ideas Network Facebook page and let us know what you think over there. Or you can always tweet us at Central Time WPR.